The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network. I'm going to talk quite a lot today about Anglo-Irish relations, the border, immigration, and I'm going to start with a quote from Jacob Rees-Mogg, that well-known intellectual thinker, MP, erstwhile cabinet minister. Perhaps we should start busing illegal immigrants to the Irish border. Then the pious Irish government, which thinks the UK is dangerous, can see the full benefit of human rights laws and open borders. But before I get to all of that, Jim, I know there's been...
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
An absolute ton of economic data that we're both dying to discuss, because a lot of it is very significant. Things are changing as we speak. So why don't you kick off discussing the economics, and I'll get to the politics a bit later on in the pod.
I want to start with Ireland's three significant pieces of data yesterday. One was the flash GDP, and it shows that during the first quarter, GDP increased by 1.1%. Okay, that means that the GDP recession, which prevailed in 2023, has ended, because we had four successive quarters of actual GDP decline in 2023. We don't get a lot of detail at this stage because it is the flash estimate, but they say it's the ICT sector that has made a strong contribution. And that is true, because it's evident from the ICT performance in the first quarter that there was a rebound. But I also think that when the detailed breakdown comes out, you will find that the exports of chemical and pharma will also have made a significant contribution. We got the flash estimate of the EU's measure of inflation, that's the Harmonized Index of Consumer Prices, the HICP, for Ireland also for April. And the annual rate has fallen to 1.6%. Okay, it's 2.4% in the euro area. So certainly the Irish inflation story is very much moving in the right direction. On a year-on-year basis, energy, food are having a significant impact on that. In fact, if you exclude food and energy from the annual rate, it's running at 2.6%. So all good on the inflation front. And the final piece of data for Ireland was retail sales. And retail sales, as I've often said, is consumer spending on physical goods, including cars. We got the March number. The volume is up 1.7% month on month. Excluding cars, it's up by 0.3%. And for the first quarter as a whole, the year-on-year growth rate in the volume is running at 2.6%, excluding cars, 1.2%. A lot of statistics there, Chris, but in a nutshell, the pace of growth in retail sales has certainly slowed down. And if you exclude the relatively strong performance of car sales during the first quarter, it was a more sober, modest growth that we saw in overall consumer spending on physical goods. And nothing surprising there, because I've spoken over a couple of podcasts recently about the cost of living pressures on the consumer sector here and the fact that consumer confidence is a little bit fragile. So that is the run through on the Irish data releases. On Tuesday morning, we got a lot of data for the euro area, first quarter GDP. And it's a story of unambiguous positivity in the main. Okay, overall eurozone growth increased by 0.3% during the quarter, meaning that the euro area also emerged from its technical recession. Germany up by 0.2%, Italy by 0.3%, France 0.2%, Portugal 0.7%, Spain 0.7%, Austria 0.2%. So growth coming through everywhere. In the case of Germany, exports and construction activity stronger. In France, it was driven by household consumption. So in a nutshell, Chris, the eurozone economy, and we've been highlighting this for quite some time now, but the eurozone economy, you know, is starting to experience some modest growth. And I would stress it is modest growth because the year-on-year comparisons are still pretty tame. But nevertheless, during the quarter, you know, a reasonably strong rebound in economic activity. Do I believe this will impact on the deliberations of the European Central Bank at the June meeting? No, I don't. I confidently, and I say confidently in inverted commas, I confidently expect the European Central Bank to deliver a 0.25% cut in June.
They must be thinking about it, though, Jim, with this rebound in activity and also the global environment. Because the one thing that's going against them with respect to their monetary policy is that famous bond yield, the cost of government borrowing. And that does impact on everything, not least central bank policy making. And the bond market, even in Europe, is telling them maybe just think about delaying that rate hike for another month or two. Would you agree with that or not?
No, I don't think so. I think they will look at the breakdown of the growth in the first quarter and conclude that, you know, it is rebounding from a pretty low base. We're still talking about relatively low levels of economic activity. And, you know, inflation, although still 2.4% in April, unchanged from March, it is moving in the right direction. And the International Monetary Fund did warn last week that the European Central Bank needs to be careful that it doesn't delay cutting rates too long and that it undershoots its inflation target. So I think there's probably a 70% probability at this juncture that the European Central Bank will actually cut in June. But there's a month to go, so let's see how the data emerges over that period.
I tend to agree with you for once on interest rates. Yes, a big wow. But with one caveat, I think that it will only take one bad piece of data, either a very strong economic growth number for the eurozone or for a large chunk of it, and or a poor inflation print for them to change their mind and just delay it for a while. That's because they keep saying they're very data dependent. And I think they will be watching what has been happening in the bond market in particular, but also what's just happening in the States. Because as we've said many, many times, we've gone from, in a very short space of time, 4 months really, from saying that there will be 6 or 7 rate cuts in the United States, to now there being doubts over whether or not there will even be 1 rate cut in the States this year. We don't operate in an economic vacuum globally, monetary policy makers least of all. So I do think those factors will have shifted their probabilities. You say 70% on for a rate cut. I think they're more sort of 55-45 at the moment. So therefore, with those odds, it wouldn't take much by way of incoming data for them to change their mind. Of course, the incoming data could reinforce the 55-45 and send it in favor of a rate cut. But I do think it is very much wait and see mode for the ECB. And they will be looking very carefully at the next month's data, not just for the eurozone, of course, but also for the globe. And I know there's a lot of data coming out for the rest of this week, which we'll discuss probably at the end of Friday for the weekend's podcast, particularly coming out of the United States. So I do think that it's still all up for grabs and things are moving along and changing, evolving as they always do, not least in the States. We've got Larry Summers, the prominent economist who got the inflation story right earlier on, saying that the natural rate of interest, the equilibrium or correct rate of interest for the states, is much higher than the Fed currently thinks it is, and that there is much more than a 20% chance of a rate hike in the states this year. The markets are currently saying 20%. He thinks it's higher. The man's got it right so far, so I think we need to respect his views. And so I do think that we are on a bit of a knife edge as to when these European rate cuts are coming. One of the things that's happened in the UK this week is that fixed mortgages have gone up. The rate of the cost of those fixed mortgages has gone up because bond yields have gone up in the United States, in the United Kingdom. Over the past month, 10-year government bond yields in the UK have gone up by the most of all the major economies, by 41 basis points. That's nearly half a percentage point. Doesn't sound like a lot, but that is in effect a half a percentage point of monetary tightening in the United Kingdom. And even in Germany, and therefore in places like Ireland, the bond yield is up by about 0.3 of a percent, which represents monetary tightening and represents the market saying to the ECB and the Bank of England, mind your eye, just be very careful about when it is that you start cutting rates, because inflation is proving just a wee bit stickier, with the notable exception of Ireland. Ireland, I think that you probably do yourself a disservice there when you talked about the Irish numbers. Ireland is a standout for the way in which the inflation number has come down to below the ECB's target. That's not true in Germany. That's not true elsewhere in the Eurozone. So that's why I think it's one of those peculiarities of the single currency area that Ireland's too small to affect anything. The ECB would love the inflation rate of the Eurozone to be the same as Ireland's, but it ain't. And that's why I think we need to be very, very careful.
This morning, Chris, Bank of Ireland issued some guidance on the first quarter, and they're basically saying that net interest income will be 3-4% below the quarter four annualized run rate, rather than 5-6% as originally forecast. Okay, so in other words, they had recently issued guidance saying that the net interest income would be 5-6% below the Q4 annualized rate, but they've now revised that down to 3-4%. And the reason for that is because they expect ECB rates to be 0.25% higher this year than they'd previously anticipated. So here we have a direct consequence of the delay in rate cuts from the European Central Bank, and it's just fueling the money printing machine that the banks have become in a rising interest rate environment.
And somebody coming in finally to take advantage of that money printing machine and offering some competition in the Irish banking market, perhaps? Yes. A little bit?
Yes, indeed. I was a little bit surprised when I saw the headline, because my view is that, you know, foreign banks would be incredibly reluctant to come into the Irish market. But Bank Inter, Spanish bank, has said it's going to come in initially and compete on the deposit side. And Bank Inter is one of the funders of Avant Money, so they already have a presence in the mortgage market here. So it's not a new investment, but it is a new area of activity. And I say bring it on. It is absolutely great news to see an international competitor bringing a bit of competition to the market and perhaps kicking the incumbent giants into a little bit of positive action.
Yeah, bring it on, I think, is the right sentiment there. Jim, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You know, last week we talked about membership of NATO, non-membership of NATO, neutrality, and whether or not for Ireland, in the long run, that's going to be compatible with membership of the EU. And we concluded it might not be, for all of the reasons that we've discussed with respect to the potential for the war in Europe that currently exists extending and NATO getting involved. I think we've got another problem building, and that refers back to the comments I made at the top of the show when I somewhat tongue-in-cheek quoted the venerable Jacob Rees-Mogg talking about the row that has broken out about refugees and the Irish border. Do you think, this is my question, that the common travel area in the long run is going to be compatible with EU membership?
Okay, Chris, we're obviously going to delve into a discussion on immigration here, and it's becoming an incredibly hot topical issue here. There are ongoing problems down in Newtown, Mount Kennedy in Wicklow, for example. We have the tent city that is growing exponentially inside Mount Street in Dublin. You know, it's absolutely nuts that this would be allowed to happen in a pretty major street in the capital city of the country. It's absolutely unbelievable to actually observe what's going on in there at the moment and the fact that it would be allowed to happen. So, you know, immigration is a huge issue. I remember, I'll answer your question eventually, Chris, okay? I remember about 10 years ago being asked to do a sort of a long-term strategic half-day presentation for one of the big four accountancy firms. And one of the areas I honed in on was global demographics. And I was using UN data on global population forecasting. And I was looking at the projected growth in population out to 2050 and to 2100, okay? And 50% of the projected growth in global population by 2050 was projected to come from 9 countries. And with the exception of the United States, the other 8 countries were what we would describe as underdeveloped economies. And I made the point back then that it was totally inconceivable that those countries would be able to absorb that sort of population growth and that, you know, migration would become a bigger and bigger global issue. And if you superimpose on top of that the impact that climate change and war are now having on migratory flows, you know, you can see why we're experiencing the problems we're experiencing now with migration. And it's become an incredibly hot, divisive, dangerous, whatever sort of adjective you want to use, issue everywhere at the moment. And it has really blown up here in Ireland in recent times. And there's some very disturbing videos going around on social media about the abuse workers, for example, who are working on hotels that may or may not have anything to do with housing migrants are coming under. So, and now, of course, we have the suggestion from the Irish government, and it hasn't been backed up with any data or facts, that the Rwandan situation is resulting in a lot of migrants coming into Northern Ireland and down into the south. Okay. And that's now given rise, obviously, to a major spat between the Irish and the UK governments, because Rishi Sunak says basically if Ireland tries to repatriate those migrants back to the United Kingdom, Britain will not accept it. So,
Jim, you haven't answered my question.
I haven't answered your question. No, Chris, I don't think the common travel area and EU is compatible with EU membership and NATO.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot of our UK listeners will say, what's the common travel area? Because it's something that's 101 years old and clearly therefore predates anything Brexity. And memories being short and historical awareness, certainly in the UK, is usually about nil. Nobody here knows what the common travel area is, what it means, how it happened, and how it actually is operationalized. For most people, it doesn't make a difference because when they visit Ireland, they still have to show passports yet when they come to the UK, they don't. So they're a bit baffled by that. But that's really how it touches most people. The most substantive bit of the common travel area that does affect a far lesser number of people are those that Irish and British people that work in each other's jurisdictions. Unlike the rest of the EU, Brits have the right to work in Ireland, full rights. They clearly lost that with Brexit for the rest of the EU. And Irish people have similar rights here in the UK. And it extends to welfare benefits and voting. And so essentially, it kind of sort of mimics the days when Ireland was part of the UK and there was complete freedom of movement on a number of levels between the two jurisdictions. And the common travel area dates back to the agreement that Britain and Ireland made when Ireland ceased to be a member of the UK. In some ways, it's a historical anachronism, but it's not that anachronistic because it has very big practical consequences for people today, not least on the Irish border. And one of the things that we've learned is that people tell a lot of fibs about immigration. And I think that the biggest fib of all is told by many politicians in many different countries. But I'm going to just mention Rishi Sunak's promise, which is that he's going to solve immigration. And in particular, he's going to solve the boat problem. He's going to stop the boat problem. I think that this is just one of the great political lies of our time, because it pretends that the immigration problem, which you, I think, very eloquently described there, is in some sense solvable. It isn't. For the reasons that you mentioned, the economy, the economic differences between countries, the environment, the environmental consequences of climate change and war, those three things are pushing an awful lot of people our way. And it's not just us, of course, here in the UK and Ireland. It's all over Europe. And indeed, the United States has its own immigration issues, particularly on the southern border. So it is a global problem to which there is no solution until you solve the three things that are causing it. Big economic differences, people seeing that they can be better off somewhere else, climate change driving them out, and war driving them out. So there's push and pull factors. And unless you could do something about all three, you're going to have people coming your way. So it's a problem that can only be managed. It isn't a problem that can be solved. And if you're going to pretend, like Rishi Sunak does, and indeed other politicians, that you can solve it, you're immediately going to run into trouble because you framed the issue incorrectly. You're looking at it in completely the wrong way. Why is the UK so popular with these people trying to come from France? There are lots of reasons for that. The most commonly cited, and we don't really know for sure, but the most commonly cited reasons why the UK is attractive is because it speaks English, and a lot of these people have English as a second or third language. There are a lot of family connections between the people coming here and people who already live here. So there is a community into which they can integrate quite quickly. But the third reason, which is less often talked about, is the fact that when you think about France with lots of borders, with lots of different countries, it's very easy to get into France across those borders from other countries. When you've got a land border, it's much easier than a sea border. But once you're in France, it's very hard to operate within the system, particularly to get a job and to get benefits and all the rest of it, because they have an identity card system. And it's very hard for an illegal immigrant, a refugee, to get one of those identity cards and therefore become legitimized, and I use the word carefully in inverted commas, and it's almost impossible for them to work in the black economy. Whereas in the UK, it's different. We don't have any land borders apart from with you. And when you get here, it's very easy to disappear into the black economy and just to disappear altogether. And that's because we don't have an identity card system. And a lot of people think that one of the ways to solve or to manage better the immigration issue in the United Kingdom is to have identity cards. I would support that, but virtually nobody else here does. The problem you face, Jim, is that I think the perception might be growing amongst a cohort of the refugee community, God bless them, is that Ireland actually is a nicer place to live than the UK. Your benefit system is certainly more generous than it is here. And as a country, the fact that you're richer than the UK, that there's so many better things in Ireland now compared to the UK. A lot of this surprises people. It surprises people in the UK and Ireland.
Surprises me, Chris.
Not just refugees, but it is. The UK is slowly going downhill, whereas the Ireland is still progressing very, very rapidly. So I think that you've got a problem. If Ireland is deemed to be a more attractive destination than the UK for those sorts of reasons, and also the fact that you're English speaking and that you don't have an identity card system, that it's very easy to get a job in Ireland without bothering to have official status. Whether that's a perception grounded in reality or not, I have a feeling that that perception is growing. And you've just given this gift to the ultra-right wing of the Conservative Party that are obsessed with immigration. It's extraordinary. And as I say, Jacob Rees-Mogg is suggesting that the UK should start busing illegal immigrants to the Irish border. There are so many aspects to this that are worth mentioning very briefly. First of all, there's the issue of numeracy. And we've had several politicians, not just your justice minister, demonstrating that they can't count. That 80% number that you quoted has been well and truly trashed, I think, by people who have tried to do the counting. We've lost a Scottish First Minister this week because he couldn't count the number of votes he had in a confidence vote if he trashed his coalition partner. Simple lack of numeracy. It's extraordinary. We've had the emergence this week, the suggestion that there was, in fact, a 2020 agreement between Britain and Ireland over right of return. Did you know anything about that agreement?
Yeah. I mean, I assumed that you were entitled to send...
Why would you assume that when you know that the UK can't send anybody back to France or Belgium or anywhere else where they come from in the EU? Why would you assume that the UK could send people back to Ireland, for instance? It's an EU-British thing, post-Brexit thing. Did you know about this 2020 agreement?
No, I didn't.
No, I certainly didn't.
No.
And apparently there is a 2020 agreement that passed us all by that your government, your Taoiseach, your Taoiseach, they all say, well, you know, there's this agreement. You've got to stick to it, guys, referring to the British government there. And the British Prime Minister said, no, you can't send your immigrants back to us because you are the EU. And it's the EU agreement, not the 2020 agreement, is the one that's important here. I suspect Sunak didn't know anything about the 2020 agreement, which essentially was a modification to, or an extension of, or just simply a restatement of the common travel area, the thing that I began this discussion with. So there's all sorts of strange things going on here. But I do think that if this has the capacity to become a real problem on your border, that 80% number has been well and truly examined and nobody's quite sure what the actual number is because these things aren't counted properly by your statisticians. I'm not sure they can count them properly. Because it seems to depend on whether somebody turns up at an immigration office in Dublin, a social welfare office, or some other institution like that, or whether they present at the airport. You know, they could still come through the airport, but still, for the first time, present themselves to the authorities elsewhere. So nobody really knows. But it's a gift. You should see the articles in publications such as The Telegraph and The Mail Online today. You could probably imagine what they're saying. They're having such fun with this because it's a stick with which to beat the EU in particular. And there's that right wing press loves doing that. And I have to hate to say this, Jim, but they're having a great fun, as Jacob Rees-Mogg is doing, having a go at the Irish. So if this has the potential, it's only that at the moment to become a really serious issue. And you've already declared today, the government in Ireland, that they're going to be deploying more guards and immigration inspectors to the border. Is this the start of the hard border coming back?
Absolutely.
Well, that violates the Good Friday Agreement.
It raises
very profound questions.
And it raises particularly profound questions for Sinn Féin.
Yeah, so we thought the border issue had been sorted out by the Windsor Agreement, which sorted out the trade issues.
Yeah.
We hope, fingers crossed, lots of doubt still around that. But we hope that had gone away and that Sunak and the Irish government had solved that particular issue of goods moving across the border. But right up until yesterday, I don't think anybody had thought about the issue of people moving across the border. Now we have an issue that potentially, politically at least, is a much bigger deal than just mere trade of goods.
And Chris, there is, you know, it's been argued that one of the reasons why we're seeing the flow of migrants into the south from the north is because of the UK's Rwandan legislation, which has just been agreed.
Well, you've handed the UK an absolute, well, the Tory party in the UK, a complete win here, which is a shame, because you can't prove or disprove the assertion that this is their Rwanda policy working.
Yeah, well, the Rwanda policy hasn't been implemented yet and won't be for some weeks. So is there a danger now that the inflow of migrants we've seen have absolutely nothing to do with that Rwandan policy, and that from here on we may see an increasing impact from that Rwandan policy, and that we ain't seen nothing yet?
Well, as I said, the reasons why people want to get into the UK are many and varied, and I went through the three main ones there. After having reached the EU, why are they still so desperate to get to the UK? And so we imperfectly understand it. I think that the Tories, of course, are going to claim that any influx of migrants from the UK to Ireland is going to be because of the deterrent effect of their Rwanda policies. And nobody will ever be able to prove or disprove that assertion, but they will. They will hammer that home. Rwanda is working. That's going to be their mantra going forward. Just look at what is happening on the Irish border. So you've handed them this absolute PR gift and headline gift to the Tory party and their friends in the media. I would be more concerned about this illegal immigration into Ireland, this refugee influx into Ireland across that border, if that point I was making about Ireland being a much nicer place to be a refugee in than the UK gains hold. I mean, that's pure supposition, that's pure speculation. But just imagine if all those people trying so hard to get into the UK suddenly realize that they can just hop on a ferry and then get the train down or a bus down from Belfast to Dublin and be in a much nicer place than pretty much anywhere else in the UK, how much that narrative, whether or not it's true, and I think there is a lot of truth in it, as I said, that could spell a lot of problems. Now, of course, the Tories will say that if I'm right, and that's why people want to go to Ireland, because it's a nicer place to be a refugee in than the UK, the UK authorities, such as they are at the moment, will say, well, that's because of our Rwanda deterrent. And that's something, you know, which we'll never be able to prove or disprove. I don't think Rwanda is going to have the deterrent effect that they think it will. Because if you think deeply about this issue, and very few people in authority in the UK do think deeply about this issue, people are willing to wish to risk their lives, to risk death crossing the channel. Are they going to be deterred by the lesser risk of being shipped off or flown off to Rwanda? So I think the deterrent effect doesn't carry any logical consistency. So I don't think it will be because of Rwanda. That some people might come to Ireland because of the Rwanda risk, obviously, but I think the main risk that you run is this narrative now that it's a place, A, that's easy to get into, B, nicer than the UK. That's the problem you got, mate.
And tell me, Chris, how does the Rwanda thing, how is it going to work? How does it, be careful my use of language here, but how does it capture the migrants that it wants to send to Rwanda?
Well, the stories over the weekend are that they're already rounding up people who have been denied asylum in the UK, that their application has been denied. And what happens under international law and therefore UK law is that if you are denied your asylum application, but nevertheless come from an unsafe country, and that you are under some kind of physical or other threat if you go back to that country, so that you might be tortured or jailed or killed or whatever. Although you might be deemed to be an illegal migrant and your asylum application declined, there's nothing you can do. And there is a right in international law to then send countries off to safe third countries. And that is what the Rwanda thing is. It is deemed by the UK government to be a safe third country. By the Irish government, it is not. By the UK Supreme Court's decision, Rwanda is not a safe country. So we've had the bizarre situation where this Rwanda legislation that you referred to earlier on, that was passed by the House of Commons, was to change a finding of fact by the UK Supreme Court. That finding was that Rwanda is not a safe country. Mm. And let's face it, Jim, it isn't.
No, it's not.
And the UK government has decided to pass a law saying that the Supreme Court was wrong in fact, which, all things considered, is a pretty remarkable development. But in keeping with a lot of other legal shenanigans that this Tory party has engaged in. So anybody that's had their asylum application turned down is now eligible to be transferred to Rwanda. And they are already rounding people up, putting them in detention centres, according to the press reports, that are likely to be on the first flights in 10 to 12 weeks, possibly flown by your own Michael O'Leary, by all accounts. He's saying he's more than willing to accommodate the British government. I suspect that a bit like his paying to go to the loo and standing up home these passengers on his aeroplanes was a publicity stunt. I think it would be terrible PR for Ryanair if its planes were the first, or indeed at all, to be taking refugees to Rwanda.
So do I, actually, because I was listening to a podcast after the Rwandan bill was passed, and they were speculating on how difficult it would be to get an airline to carry these people. And within 24 hours, I'd seen that comment from Michael O'Leary, and I was thinking that certainly would not be a good look for Ryanair. Anyway, Chris, I'm displaying a lot of ignorance here about the legal technicalities around migration. I actually thought that the first country where migrants disembark, they have responsibility.
Well, there is something called the Dublin Agreement, ironically, yeah. I suppose. And the UK is just not part of that anymore.
Right.
So when the UK was part of the EU, it had the right, not necessarily followed up by much action, it has to be said, but it had the right to return refugees to anywhere in the EU. As I say, that's the Dublin Agreement that governs that particular aspect of migration. But as part of the Brexit process, they came out. So the French in particular have said, well, no, you can't do it anymore.
Okay. It's an incredibly dangerous area to talk about, because you're immediately deemed as right-wing, fascist, whatever, and racist, homophobic, whatever sort of adjective they want to throw at you. So it's a very difficult topic to actually discuss in a rational way. But and the scenes down in Newtown Mount Kennedy were extraordinary last Thursday night, for example. And one of the problems here, of course, is that these demonstrations are being hijacked by the wrong people, okay? And they're being just used to flog out a right-wing anti-immigrant narrative. But you can also put yourself in the shoes of the local residents in Newtown Mount Kennedy, you know, and the notion of whatever, 160 people being brought into their small town stroke village to live in tents. It's not a very enticing prospect, is it?
No. And as you say, if you delve into this in a particular way, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. And so let's not try and do that. I think we tried to discuss this as factually and as rationally as we can. I'm going to conclude. I could go on all day about this, but I'll stop soon, I promise. We're already out of time. There's a great blog, Substack, by a guy called Matthew Iglesias. He's a very successful Substacker, just like ourselves, really. And he is, in his recent piece, is having a go at this whole left-right thing that you were alluding to there, about the worry that you end up being labelled inappropriately. And it's really interesting the way he discusses it. And let me just quote this to you. I'm very interested in what you think about this. If you look at the core political weakness of contemporary centre-left parties, a lot of it comes down to wanting to care about the interests of refugees and wanting to care about the global impact of climate change. I, that's Matty Iglesias, think progressive-minded people need to proceed carefully around these topics, which I think is your point, and avoid counterproductive overreach. Of course, nobody really wants to make personal sacrifices in the here and now to reduce the suffering induced by coastal flooding in Nigeria in the 2080s. At the same time, rationally speaking, Nigerians are human beings just like you and me, and their interests count, as do the interests of people in the future. It's bad politics to stand up for those interests, but it is morally correct to observe that people ought to care about them. You ought to care about the interests of poor people. You ought to worry about the welfare of chickens. You should bend over backwards to worry about the interests of racial and ethnic minorities being scanted in democratic politics. dealing with progressive politics can be exhausting, which I think, again, was your point, Jim. Yeah. And it's genuinely bad that progressive movements sometimes cultivate an atmosphere of anxiety and depression, which has always been my criticism of the left, is that they're just so bloody miserable. But the idea that it's good to be less self-directed is correct. The conservative patch of trying to address all these concerns through the afterlife or divine justice is psychologically comforting, but not persuasive or true. A lot of conservatism strikes me as morally and intellectually lazy failure to attempt any empathy or empirical rigor. He goes on, it's a really, really interesting piece. And he concludes by saying that a related issue in a practical sense is that there is a preponderance of smart people who are on the left. And that's why you can see the universities erupting in the United States. They're all left-wing protesters. And it's the case that there are very, very few smart people on the right. He acknowledges that people like Tucker Carlson is clearly a smart person. But the problem is, there aren't very many smart people on the right, and that creates an imbalance in the way the whole thing is debated and discussed. As I say, it's a very really in-depth, deep thinking piece about modern politics that I'd urge anybody to have a look at. And I'd love you to, I know you haven't read it because it's only just out, but I'd love to have a bigger, more in-depth discussion of it later on. But I think it speaks to that point that you were making about how if you get into these issues, you immediately get labeled, you know, this left-wing, right-wing thing in the very modern way. And I'll conclude that one of the many ways that I feel like a dinosaur these days is that I am of the old industrial working class left. That's my background. That's the root of my politics through what the jobs that my father and grandfather did. They, you know, they were steel workers and dockers.
Of course, that was very totally consistent with your successful career in the city.
Well, some people would doubt that word success, Jim, but let's move on from that. But I feel like a dinosaur because that kind of lefty is almost extinct now. It's these progressive, hyper-educated left-wing academics that dominate left-wing thinking now who have no connection to the industrial working classes. In fact, they're all probably upper middle class or just upper class themselves. So the whole class structure of left and right politics has changed completely. And I think it's very important to understand that as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll shut up there.
Okay, Chris, listen, this is obviously something we will be returning to because it ain't going away as an issue. So listen, good to talk.
Cheers, Jim, as always.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.